It's time for To The Last Drop podcast with Liam Del Calm and Brendan Nell.
Welcome back. It's To The Last Drop podcast. I'm Brendan Nell, and with me again, as normal, is Liam Del Calm. Liam, this weekend we heard it was the World Cup final that everybody wanted. Do you agree?
I think we need to define everyone. I mean, it's a very broad statement to suggest that you're speaking on behalf of the entire world, of humanity as we know it. So, no, I don't agree with it. I think there certainly would have been a sentiment in France and in Ireland that there's unfinished business. But as for the rest of the world, I don't think we particularly care what they think.
Yeah, of course, we're talking about the Six Nations opening game, Ireland and France, which Ireland handily won, really outclassed France. But I think my apt description would probably be more the fifth place playoff that everybody wanted.
Okay, you don't need to remind them of it. But yeah, look, I mean, they obviously fell short in the quarterfinals of the World Cup, and they felt that in both instances that they had a lot more to offer at the last World Cup. But that's the nature of the beast. I mean, if you play in a semi-final or in a quarter-final of a World Cup, you know, there's every chance of you falling short, and this is what's happened again. I mean, I don't know how many times we're going to say this about Ireland, but they came up short again at the quarter-final stage. France would probably feel more hurt given what they've invested in that World Cup. Obviously, home soil.
Invested is an interesting word.
Well, and it's pointed. I mean, you know, they did everything they could to bring some joy to the French rugby public, but it wasn't to be, and that's the nature of World Cups. I mean, people are going to leave disappointed. They're going to feel that they didn't fire all their shots, and there will be regret. And the 4 years to the next World Cup, I think that's the thing that sort of weighs you down mostly. The fact that you're going to have to wait that long before you can rectify, the things that you feel that you should have done right. But, you know, if you look at the Irish performance, I think they've embraced it. I mean, they've basically gone out there and said, like, you know what, we're going to keep at it.
Well, I think just my parting shot on that little comment from the commentator was it's quite rich calling it the World Cup final if your team's never got past the quarterfinal to try and get in. So, but that's not, I mean, that was one throwaway comment. I think we could spend the whole day laughing about that. I think, yeah, turning to their performance, it was quite a clinical, incredible performance by the Irish. I think we all expected this. You know, the last 2 years we've seen these ding-dong battles between them that eventually the stranglehold, the arm wrestle gets broken right near the end of the game. And this one wasn't even a contest. It was over for 10 minutes in the game. And by the time Paul Willemse left the field with the red card, it was, 17-0. So it was the game was all over by then. And, of course, that probably galvanized France a bit. But, two points there. One, at this level of the game, if you're still tackling like Paul Willemse did, you shouldn't actually. He was very lucky not to get the red card in the first yellow card, and the second card wasn't even a question. So, that's the. And secondly, I just thought Ireland were a class above the French on the day.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think if you look at Ireland, it was kind of the performance that you expected from them, especially if you look at their record over the last few years. There were question marks about how they would go in the absence of a Johnny Sexton and maybe a couple of other senior players, but they seem to have gone about that in a very seamless way. They were, at the start, Jack Crawley, the guy who plays fly off now, filling big boots, a couple of wobbles at the start, but he came through it in the end with flying colors. So Ireland, obviously in that position now, have a few options, but he seems to be the guy now in pole position. Joe McCarthy in the second row, stellar performance away from home. In front of a hostile crowd, stood up marvelously in that test, and as I said earlier, I mean, it's the kind of performance that you expect from Ireland, and has probably set them up for another Grand Slam because there was a lot of talk before the game about whoever wins this game might actually go on to win the Grand Slam. I know it's early days, But that's the way they've set up this particular instalment of the Six Nations. There is the risk of it being a damp squib, you know, after the first round of matches.
Well, definitely so. And I think just on your first comment about Jack Crawley, I saw a tweet that really made me laugh. It was when the Irish guys who on Twitter who sent out this tweet saying, who knew it was Johnny Sexton holding us back all these years?
I saw that as well, yeah.
That really made me chuckle. But what a performance. And I think also, if you put it in context, Marseille, I mean, I know they play in Paris most of the time, but Marseille is normally one of France's strongholds. And to win in that sort of fashion in Marseille, okay, fair enough, it was against 14 men, so you've got to take that into account. But yeah, that was really impressive. And I think with one eye on July this year, where Ireland will be coming to South Africa, I think they've really laid down the marker. I think we realize that if you want to talk about possible World Cup finals that nobody saw, that almost would be what you're talking about in July, not in the Six Nations. Because when Ireland come down here, there's certainly some unfinished business for the Springboks. They've lost against Ireland the last two times they played them.
What is it, 5 out of the last 7 or something?
Yeah, it's not a good record. Mm. And, while Russi and Jacques and the Boks have climbed so many mountains and lifted so many trophies, that is probably the one thing that probably still bugs them, knowing them like we do. Mm. And they'd want to set that record straight in July. But it also shows how tough that challenge is going to be. Ireland went to New Zealand and won a test series there. What we saw on Friday night, you could easily say they backed themselves to win a test series in South Africa as well.
Yeah, you mentioned the word mountains there, and it was a significant peak for them to win in France, in Marseille. I mentioned earlier a hostile environment. It's different to the Stade de France, which is just this massive stadium with a lot of people in it. Marseille is different because the crowd feels like they're on top of you. I think they probably make more noise there than they do in Paris. Mm-hmm. So it was a huge effort for them to win that game, and I think almost ideal preparation for a trip to Loftus later this year, because if you can win there, you can, you know, you'll look at a trip to Loftus. Admittedly, altitude will be a different challenge, but in terms of sort of overcoming their own demons and sort of emboldening them, I think that was significant. I think it's also significant that we play the first test against them at Loftus and not at the coast, to sort of try and get onto the front foot and not make the mistake the Boks did in 2016 when they lost the first one in Cape Town.
Yeah. Well, I think there's one sort of caveat to that. And if and I've got no reason to think that some of the reporting wasn't true, but if it means we're going to be playing Wales in the warm-up game at Twickenham the week before the Loftus game, that almost negates your advantage at altitude a bit. A lot of the players should be used to it. Plus, there's an interesting question now in the rest of the URC, because Leinster, which supplies almost the entire Ireland team, at least the bulk of them, have got to come to South Africa again. They've got to come play on the Highveld at some point. And with them being top of the URC log at the moment, do they send a weakened side like they normally do? Or with Ireland a bit later in mind, do they send a full-strength side to utilize the conditions a bit more, get used to that? That's going to be an interesting thing to watch. And, of course, how much influence, and I know it's maybe a moot point because they're different teams, but how much influence Jacques Nienaber will have on those Leinster players ahead of playing the Springboks. And I'm not saying Jacques's going to give away any state secrets, but just his whole presence and his attitude and the way you approach defence and the way you approach games, that'll rub off on some of those Leinster players before they face the Springboks. And, I think we know it's going to be an extremely tough task to win those test matches, but not something the Springboks can't do. It's good, looking forward to a mouth-watering clash at Loftus, and it's going to be interesting.
Touched something interesting there in that you mentioned that Jacques won't give away state secrets, but isn't that the nature of the beast now, that you can take up a new position and you paid for your expertise? How much do you share? This is almost like enough fodder for a different podcast, but
yeah,
as a professional coach. Well, where do you draw the line?
Well, you could see it already, and we're moving just that we can move on to the next game there, because you could see it already in England's defence, which suddenly using the rush defence, and they suddenly have a new assistant coach.
Well, they haven't quite grasped it, yes, as you can.
But they were definitely trying it out,
and
you could definitely see things that were learned from the Springboks approach in that game. Just how good England are is a very interesting question that is going to be debated a lot in the UK over the next couple of weeks. I thought it was a terrible performance for them, and I was actually, I must admit, I was quite impressed with Italy, although by the time the end of the game came, I felt this is such a typical Italian performance, do so much to get so close and then fall so short again. And you just sort of, it was frustrating to watch. I don't think England really deserved to win. And I thought another point about commentary there, if you listen to the commentary of that game, whoever was Martin Gillingham's co-commentator, if that England team was playing that he was describing, they should have won by 50 because they apparently were so brilliant.
Yeah, it is frustrating sometimes to listen to the comments, you know, when you watch Six Nations. Yeah, look, it wasn't a performance that England should be particularly proud of, but, you know, it's I think there'll be a job in progress for a while still under Borthwick. I don't think one should be too tough on them just yet. I think once they play the likes of Ireland and France, they're not going to have room for the same kind of mishaps, especially on defence. So they're going to be judged a little bit differently then. So, there are certainly some improvements they need to make, because it's either going to be a case of they get drawn closer to France and Ireland, or they stay mid-table, if not slide backwards, well behind Scotland if they're not careful.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that brings us to that third game of that weekend as well, which was Scotland-Wales, which I know some friends of ours who stopped watching at halftime when Scotland were 20 points up and then missed the entire comeback, and where Wales came back quite incredibly in that game, although you didn't really feel Scotland were going to lose that game at any point. It turned out to be probably, from just a fan's point of view, the most entertaining game of the weekend. And it was a good watch, but Scotland are good, but they still don't have that sort of steeliness that you think
they have soft moments.
They won't really trouble France or Ireland. You don't think that at the moment. They'll come close, but they looking at those opening three games, there's not really that much competition for Ireland.
No, especially now after the first one is done. So I think they will probably go on and win another Grand Slam. Now it's a question of, do England or do Scotland seize the moment and make sure they can get past France and maybe secure second place, which will be an improvement for them as well. So I just feel that a lot of the interest in the competition would have probably taken a step back. After last week, there's no doubt about that. You could, of course, have some cracking games further down the line, but in terms of who wins this thing, I think that ship has sailed.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at the fixtures for this week, I mean, Scotland, France, and England, Wales on Saturday, and Ireland, Italy on Sunday. Scotland's test will be France, and Fabien Galtier is under a bit of pressure. Probably the first time he has been under pressure as French coach.
There was no disgrace in losing to Ireland, but it's the manner in which it happened.
Yeah, and you could see he didn't take it very well. If you see the comments at the post-match, he didn't want to discuss it. He didn't want to linger on what happened. And it was almost, I'm trying to think of the word, not sulking, but he was almost, sort of didn't really want to face what had happened.
It was a bit indignant, actually.
Not at all typical of French people at times, is it?
Look, when you draw something out of him, when he's prepared to speak, then he can be quite forthright. So, so obviously that would have stung. And you're right, I think he will feel a bit of pressure. There's no doubt that France will be better in their next game I think going forward in this competition. But I think this will speak to their desire to want to be better, because I have no doubt that the World Cup and the disappointment there must have lingered a little bit.
No, I mean, you were there and you saw the reaction of the French fans and the way they were. It was catastrophic for them as such. But, yeah, they've got to bounce back against Scotland. That's probably the game of the weekend. England-Wales, you almost... Yeah, I suppose we'd see who's best of a bad bunch, I suppose, at this moment. But I don't know. I don't know if Wales, despite that flurry in the second half, if they're that good.
No.
So whether they can do it 2 weeks in a row is an interesting one. And Ireland, to me, will probably, Italy will be competitive, but they'll probably lose about 20, 30 points at the end.
Yeah, I think Wales, with the relative inexperience in their team, I think game management will be an issue for them. But, you know, so you're going to have these pockets of them playing out of their socks for a couple of minutes, but to sustain it over 80 minutes, I don't think they're there yet. And as for England, and as much as we're saying that they're a work in progress, I think there's enough there. I think they've got enough experience to see them through in key moments. So you've got to go England in that game.
Before we get to, obviously, the big news in South Africa for the week, which is obviously Rassie Erasmus's reappointment as Springbok coach, I think let's talk about the one game that, if it was built properly, would have been one of the highlights of the weekend, but almost slipped by unnoticed by 95% of the rugby world. It was a game in Cork between Munster and the Crusaders, which is the... puts the Super Rugby champions, technically, against the URC champions. Of course, some caveats to that. The Super Rugby champions have lost their coach, who's gone on to coach, Scott Robertson's gone on to coach the All Blacks. So they've got a new coach. And then they were also at their first game of a pre-season, so they wouldn't have been highly tuned, whereas Munster were without all their Ireland players and have a number of injuries and are mid-season. So it was hard to really get a grasp of the game, but it didn't underline two things for me. One being that South Africa made the right choice in going north. I don't think there's a drop in standard in terms of that. The fact that Munster won the game 21-19, it's difficult to judge just how good they were. But I don't think, I think it's almost underlined that point for me. And then the second point for me was just how desperately we need a global season. A game like this should be played by two full-strength sides in a top-billing, televised, worldwide extravaganza.
It's one of those things where you almost say from the outset, what's the point? Because unless you're going to have two teams in tip-top shape, got their best players, have built up to that moment, I think as an idea, you know, it's a good one, putting the best in the Southern Hemisphere against the best in the North. But, yeah, and unless you can put the best players and the best resources out there, it's not worth having.
Yeah, I watched the highlights about the only thing we could, because it wasn't obviously on TV in South Africa. I don't think it was on TV other than maybe select New Zealand and maybe in somewhere in Ireland it was on TV.
You're almost suggesting it shouldn't have been shown anywhere.
No, I wouldn't go that far. I watched the highlights. That shows me I would have watched it. But, yeah, the Crusaders tries were pretty much all long-range, typical New Zealand efforts, and the Munster tries were pretty much line-out mauls and pick-and-goes. And
all very predictable, then.
Predictable. So in 5 minutes, it probably summed it up. But, yeah, also left you without that that good taste in your mouth that you'd want after such a potentially big game. And hopefully the next time it happens, some people at World Rugby have got their house in order, because I think a bigger question than that, and we've discussed this before and we'll discuss it again probably at length at times, is currently probably we're at the worst part of this, that the global season isn't aligned, because our Springboks play in what should be our off-season. Our Box have to get, at this time of year, have to get 6 weeks off during the URC season. And now with the Currie Cup moving to late August, September, players who are playing in the Currie Cup who play in the URC have to get an 8-week window of complete break as well in the middle of the URC, which makes that management for any coach ridiculously difficult. And until the global season sorted out, we're going to have this problem over and over and over again. So let's hope somebody listens at World Rugby. I'm not quite sure anybody does, but let's hope so.
It's a case of, yeah, where's the money and how does that impact us? Why does it impact the bottom line?
Yeah, sometimes it feels like two spoiled children with their toys in different corners of a room. Anyway, they don't want to play together. But anyway, let's move on to something a bit better. Maybe not the biggest state secret that Rossi re-signed until 2027. I think probably if there was one surprise is the fact that we've all been hearing talk that he was going to re-sign until 2025. And then Adam is one of the stick or deal, and Davids would have probably taken over. The fact that he's committed to another full World Cup cycle, the chance of winning, being part of a team that wins three World Cups in a row, and some interesting assistant coaches that he's put in place, tells me that passion and that fire is very much still there for Rossi to win another World Cup.
Yes, I mean, I wasn't entirely surprised by the, you know, the duration of the contract, the fact that he's going to go to 2027, because as much as they talked up the resources they have within their coaching structure, it was never clear that somebody else from within was going to definitely take over. They always try to douse those fires. So I wasn't surprised. Now, whether that one should interpret that as a vote of no confidence in the guys who have been in the system, that's for people to decide. As far as the additions they've made to the coaching structure is concerned, the Tony Brown addition certainly for me is an interesting one, and one that certainly holds a lot of promise. I think he can drag quite a few players along with him. Especially if you look at the way the box have evolved over the last year and a half or 2 years, a player like Mani Lebok, for instance, could benefit hugely from a guy like Tony Brown. He won't be the only one; there are others as well. But just from the outside, I think that's probably the one that enthuses me most.
Yeah, I think Tony definitely is the one that's Jerry Flannery's been doing a good job with Harlequins with defence, and he did coach with Rossi and Jacques at Munster years ago, so that's not a surprise. I think the other one that was interesting to me was our guest from a few weeks ago, Jakob Paper, being appointed full time to the Bok management as a laws advisor, and that tells me, and now maybe
he hinted at some point.
He did. He did say he had some role, but he wouldn't tell us at that point. And that tells me that it's going to probably drive the overseas guys crazy, but all Rossi's interesting theories about, I wouldn't say manipulating the laws, but tweaking the laws to your advantage, like the 7-1 bench and the bomber squad and things like that. He's now got a full-time law advisor that can help him look for these loopholes in the system. And, it's not that Jakob Paper hasn't helped the box out before, because he has worked with
him
before.
Yeah, it's different now.
But it's different now. His job is actively to see ways that they can, I wouldn't say exploit the laws, but use the laws to their advantage.
Yeah, I don't know how Yaku's going to manage it, because remember he told us that he's got all these other things to do as well. He's got his business to run, or businesses to run. He's going to spend time at home. So, it's going to be interesting for him. But, yeah, look, it's a wonderful addition to the Bok setup. They, of course, have worked with referees extensively for many years. We've seen referees come in and out of that camp or that setup. For many years. So to have somebody on a permanent basis just sort of solidifies that entire drive to, I won't say short-circuit the system where you can, but it does give them an edge.
Plus, I mean, given the history that we know that the Bok have had with referees in the last couple of years, having somebody there who has an inside lane, who has the numbers, home numbers of everybody on the World Refing Panel, surely can't hurt. Yaku's worked with Joel Zhutke and all the other refs across the world rugby for so long that, I mean, for him to make a quick call to somebody is probably a lot better than Rossi doing that after a game, and not making any videos or anything like that. I think it's a very shrewd point, and it's probably a step further from having Nigel Owens that they wanted.
I was about to say, I mean, we've got absolutely no right to call Yaku the poor man's Nigel Owens.
I don't think any of us did.
Yeah, we shouldn't.
No. Papes is, it's going to be interesting. I'd love to know what that conversation with his wife was like, because he made that point quite clear to us in our podcast that he has to spend more time. His daughters are getting bigger, and he needs to be at home more. And the Boks do travel quite a bit in the year. So there's lots of camps and lots of other things. But the other appointment was Dwayne Vermeulen, which we saw coming quite
a while. Roving number eight.
As a roving coach, which is quite an interesting role. We'll still get probably a bit more clarity on what that probably means. But it probably means that he's going to be the almost ambassador for Springbok rugby, going around smoothing things over with the provinces. He's played at most of the provinces he has to go visit.
Almost like an enforcer of the blueprint.
And I'd like to see some of those CEOs might be quite intimidated by having to face Dwayne on certain things. But I think that's an interesting role for him. And potentially, I won't say now in 4 years' time, because maybe that's a bit too early, but potentially a successor at some point to Rossi.
Yeah, it'll be difficult to draw anybody in authority on that matter and see if they will nudge us closer. But I think in one way or another, he will certainly be higher up the pecking order there. There's no doubt in time to come.
I think we'll probably see some sort of, as a roving coach, we might see him in a role that maybe takes a SAA side like Mzwandile Stick did, or some sort of invitational team at some point against somebody, just to give him a bit more of those coaching credentials. And but I think
and I suppose man management. I mean, that's absolutely key. You can have all the IP that is required for a top job like that, but you need the people skills, the man management. Are we allowed to say man management? Yes, we are.
Yeah, we are. It's the men's team.
So. Yeah, so, I think, it'll be very interesting to track his development from here on in.
Yeah, I think, and coming back to just the point we made at the beginning of this part of the discussion about Mzwandile Stick and Dion Davids, I think part of the issue that probably came up, at least maybe from an SA Rugby side, is they saw what happened in New Zealand with Ian Foster succeeding Steve Hansen. And almost, sort of being ushered into the job. Now, they did it with Jacques Nienaber in a way, and it worked for them, but Rossi was always around. Mm. I think there was a bit of a danger that, and with nothing against, because Dwayne Vermeulen probably falls in that category as well then, nothing against the two gentlemen I've spoken to or any of the assistant coaches, but when you've had somebody who hasn't almost had the Springbok coaching credentials on their own, and Jacques had the same problem in the beginning. Mm. The public are a lot more critical, and they're a lot more, they don't accept your mistakes as easily. And we saw that with Ian Foster. The New Zealand public was extremely critical because he wasn't Steve Hansen. And they tend to turn on you a lot quicker. Mm. It's going to be interesting just to see their roles going forward. I think, that rest of the team's going to probably work as well as they've worked over the last 6 years. But two things just lastly from my side on that. One being, I think this is probably going to be the most difficult World Cup cycle, and that's saying something, given the fact that the first World Cup cycle, Rossi had 18 months to prepare a team.
It's an interesting one in that the first one, there was less expectation. Now you're coming as double World Champs with a squad that needs to be rebuilt, but you have the expectation. Yeah.
So, and then the second, obviously, cycle, we had the Lions Tour and COVID, which the Boks lost a year of Test Rugby, and then had a sort of a season where they had COVID restrictions and all sorts of quarantines and things like that, and didn't really have the time to build a team. So now they've got hopefully a full, we don't know what the future holds.
But a normal, supposedly normal.
Supposedly normal four-year cycle coming up. And if in that case, as you say, an aging squad, how many of these guys are going to be around in the next World Cup? I'm sure a fair chunk of them will, but will they still be in the same form? Will they still be as dominant? And will they still be the same players in the team, and what new players will have come through? And we're seeing, if you look across the URC teams, all four sides scrums are pretty potent. There's some real good youngsters coming through. You see at halfback guys like Sanele Nohamba coming through. There's some great midfielders coming through, Henko van Veek, for instance, and Sasha Feinberg and Ngomzulu and a couple of the others. So there's a bunch of players over the next couple of years that we're going to see start challenging these guys for things. Plus, you've got the rest of the world who's not just irritated that you won the World Cup. You've won double World Cups, and now you've even got, they're more determined to get you off that perch.
Yeah.
And then the one thing, final thing for me is that the fact that the Boks have never been a good team between World Cups. They've struggled between World Cups. And that would be the big challenge for me, if they can change that, you know, to lead into a World Cup cycle.
Do you want to be Ireland?
No. And not New Zealand of old as well. It used to be the best team between World Cups as well. But I think a bit more consistency between World Cups. I don't expect them to win everything.
Yeah, but to be fair, if you're going to build towards something, it's going to be give and take. And I know in the moment, it's almost our job to be critical when things do go pear-shaped, because from time to time it will. I mean, the Wales test in Bloemfontein is probably a prime example. But it'll be very interesting to see what they do for that Wales test. Do they do the same as they did in 2018? I mean, is it going to be a one-week gap or a two-week gap between that test and the Ireland gap? Because if it's a two-week gap, it gives them more leeway.
Yeah.
If it's a one-week gap, do they then go with a bunch of new players that they think can sort of walk the distance with them to the next World Cup? And then sort of hold back, you know, your World Cup winners from last year and prepare them for that test series. I think they're probably better served if there was a two-week gap.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. And also then I suppose the other thing that comes into play is if a South African team does well in the URC, like the Stormers were in the last two finals, those players, obviously, you've got to take into account, they might not play in that game as well, depending on the timing. So, yeah, there's a lot of questions around this and a lot we're going to see.
There'll be 2 weeks, I think, between the URC final and then, well, we don't know whether it's going to be a week out from the Ireland game or 2 weeks out. Yeah. So, but there'll be a fortnight, I think, at least.
There usually is. Yeah. So, yeah, I haven't looked at the calendar just yet, but if I believe right, there was 2 weeks. But, yeah, either way, that test still has to be officially confirmed. So we'll wait for that, for the official confirmation. But yeah, lots to talk about, lots to see, and it's definitely going to be an interesting couple of months. So lots to talk about this week, and we didn't even have a guest, and we talked all the time there.
Yeah, let me just take this last sip of this wonderful bottle of red wine, and you can sign off on that note.
We talked so much, you wouldn't even have thought we had a bottle of red wine, yeah. Anyway, that's To The Last Drop. Join us again next week. We'll be talking more rugby, and till then, chat then.
Cheerio.
Thanks for listening. And a reminder, you can find all the To The Last Drop podcasts on the Brendan Nell YouTube channel, iono.fm, Spotify, player.fm, Pocket Casts, Google Podcasts, and iTunes, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.